Guajira, Guantanamera. We're now about to have a conversation with Dr. Aviva Chomsky in our continuing conversations and looks at Fidel Castro, the death of Fidel this week at 90 years old, who was one of the great figures in history and one of the great figures in the revolutionary world and on this planet. And Dr. Aviva Chomsky, of course, is a professor of history and the coordinator of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at the Salem State University in Massachusetts. And when we last talked to her, it was about her book Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal, and joins us now to reflect on Fidel and more. She's traveled to Cuba numerous times and knows a great deal about that nation and its people and the revolution itself. And Aviva Chomsky, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me to be on again.
So it's interesting. One of the things that some of the young people have been quoted in Havana and Santiago and Matanzas and other places in Cuba is that they can't believe he's dead because they figured he'd live forever. So when we reflect on what Fidel Castro meant for Cuba and the world, his revolution overthrowing the dictator Fulgencio Batista in 1959. Take us back a bit because, you know, I can't assume, let's not assume, as a teacher I know you don't assume, yet people really understood what that moment was like in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Yeah. I think in a sense when people say that they can't believe Fidel Castro is dead because it seems like he'll never die, I think speaking as a historian, that From a certain perspective, that is completely true. That is not in the literal sense, obviously. He's mortal and has now passed away. But in a historical sense, that is the importance of some sort of towering figures and the impact that they make on the world and what they symbolize in terms of history, like that doesn't change just because the immortal individual passes away. So I think in that respect, Fidel Castro is not dead in the sense that his historical meaning doesn't disappear just because the human being dies. So, you know, to think about the context of the late 1950s and early 1960s, the end of World War II, the sort of collapse of Europe, the emergence of the United States as the world's single superpower, and the real push in the colonized world to take advantage of this historical moment to overturn the colonial regime that really has controlled the world for the previous almost 500 years. Of Europe, European domination of the entire world. And this is particularly the case in Asia, places like Vietnam, and in Africa, where countries still struggling against colonial rule, rule by the very powers who, during World War II, were claiming to be fighting for democracy and self-determination and the rights of peoples, but really they meant that only for white peoples, not for their colonies. So in the aftermath of World War II, we see this huge movement for decolonization, and I think we have to see the Cuban Revolution in the context of these decolonization movements. And these happened not only among countries that had been colonized that were fighting for their liberation, but also peoples who were colonized in the United States. That is, this is when we see a real upsurge of Black political organizing, of Native American political organizing, of Chicano political organizing, of colonized peoples fighting for demanding their rights, going to the streets to demand their rights, and when they can't achieve them peacefully, taking up arms to demand their rights. So the Cuban Revolution, successful in 1959, holds a huge symbolic weight for being the one revolution in the Americas that successfully challenged U.S. domination, U.S. imperialism, and that really served as a beacon symbolically but also materially in terms of its support for anti-colonial revolutionary movements and anti-racist movements around the world.
So one of the things of the years that Fidel Castro was a national leader and in power, and even these last 10 years when he was not in charge of the events in Cuba because he became ill, there's always been these contradictions for many people about Fidel Castro. On the one hand, when you go to Cuba, there's one thing that becomes glaringly clear, that if you look, here's the issue of race and racism, let's say, just for as example. People will tell you that racism still exists in Cuba, and it's there, and you can feel it and see it as palpable when you talk to people. On the other hand, one of the things that somebody said to me in Cuba was, unlike America, what Cuba did under Fidel and under the Communist Party in Cuba was to address the systemic issues of racism, not try to create brotherhood, and change the lives of people. And you meet so many like black Cuban families whose children and grandchildren are doctors and they're lawyers and they're engineers and they're in college and saying this could never have happened otherwise. And it's just, so and then again, you have people saying, well, look, he put dissidents in jail. He didn't allow a free press. Didn't allow a democracy as we think about it in the West. And how we weigh these contradictions when it comes to Fidel and the revolution that he and his comrades brought to Cuba and to the world.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think Cuba is the one and only country of the Americas under the Cuban Revolution that really made a systematic effort to uproot racism. And that saw race and class as interrelated phenomena. That is, programs that were aimed at opening opportunities for poor people were combined with programs that were aimed at specifically opening opportunities for the large proportion of Cubans of African descent who were overwhelmingly overrepresented among the direly poor of people living in dire poverty in Cuba. It's hard to even conceptualize how radical the socioeconomic measures that were taken, especially over the course of the 1960s, were to really uproot the political and economic structures that had been imposed on Cuba through centuries of colonialism, and most recently in the 20th century, primarily by U.S. colonialism. The sugar industry, a long history of enslavement of Africans and people of African descent, by the sugar industry, which increasingly came into the hands of American sugar growers in the late 19th century, and the depth of rural poverty created by this export economy, along with the profits for a few. So this is sort of the typical colonial and Latin American social structure of a lot of wealth controlled by foreigners, mostly the United States and U.S. corporations, a very corrupt government that works in league with the U.S. government to maintain this system, and abject poverty of the vast majority of the population who are turned into a sort of semi-coerced working class, working in these extractive industries that create profits and products for outsiders by exploiting the land and the labor of Latin Americans. So this is sort of a classic colonial structure that continues to exist after independence in Latin America, except that it becomes what Cubans call neo-colonialism. That is, it's done informally through dictators allied with the United States rather than through direct colonial rule by European countries, as we see in Africa, for example, during the same time period. So to uproot these structures required massive and profound changes in the economy, eliminating the possessing classes and redistributive efforts that, as you said, created a kind of equality that really exists nowhere else in the world. And one of the ways that we can see this is that Cuba is the only country in the world where public health indicators are the same across the races. Infant mortality, maternal mortality, lifespan, all of these are not defined by race in Cuba anymore, as they are everywhere else in the world. And Cuba is often compared to Brazil and the United States, the two other countries with large Afro-descended populations, where the public health disparities are just shocking and striking, and in Cuba they're not. And I think it's the... So this is one way in which Cuba's attempt to eliminate racial inequality is really dramatic. The other thing is, and this is both at a material and symbolic level, was Cuba's commitment to overturning white colonial regimes in Africa and their support for African liberation movements and for revolutionary governments in Africa. And this means both material support, military support, but also what's often overlooked is their educational and health missions abroad in Africa and in poor countries in Latin America and elsewhere in the world. However, as you say, it's also true that Cuba did not develop the kind of liberal democracy that we enjoy, so to speak, in the United States. Now, I would say that especially at this particular moment in time, there's a lot of people in the United States that would say, you know, this system of liberal electoral democracy that we have has some flaws, too. It's not exactly the perfect system for people's involvement in government and control over their lives and the decisions that affect their lives. I would say if you only look at the level of abstention in the most recent U.S. election, you can see that about half of the U.S. voting population is disenchanted enough with our so-called democratic system that they choose not even to vote. And among those who voted, you also have large numbers saying, well, I really didn't like the candidate I voted for very much, but I just felt like I had to because I disliked the other one even more. So, you know, I think this is a particularly apt moment for us to look critically at how our own electoral democracy works. But clearly, Cuba has followed a very different path towards citizen mobilization and citizen input into decision-making processes. I think it's an important exercise for us to look at Cuba's system on its own terms and not just try to measure it by the terms of the United States and say, everywhere in which it differs from the United States, it must be bad. I think it's a much more useful exercise to study Cuba's political system on its own terms and say, okay, what are some of the great achievements? What are some of the strengths? And what are some of the weaknesses? And I think we could ask the same questions of our own system.
So I wonder if when you look at this history of Cuba, this last 59, 60 years of of Fidel being in his government being in power, that began at a time when the Soviet Union and the United States were at each other's throats. They were the two main hegemonic powers in the globe at that time. You might put China in the mix, but they were the two main hegemonic powers. And people would say that sometimes the Soviet Union was the only bulwark against world capitalism taking over the planet. But on the other hand, what you also saw was that that Fidel perhaps – some people would argue that Fidel's following the Soviet orthodoxy in terms of economics, mm-hmm. that has put Cuba in a difficult situation now, in a place where it opens itself to the West and capitalism coming in and taking over.
Absolutely. But let me just reformulate a little bit something that you said.
Please do. I'll go right ahead. Go ahead.
I would say that World War II ended with a unipolar world, not a bipolar world.
All right.
That is, the Soviet Union was absolutely destroyed in World War II. Just think about where World War II was actually fought and who were actually the victims of World War II. World War II was primarily a war of Germany against the USSR and a war of Japan against China. So those two countries that you mentioned as the potentially other most powerful countries in the world were decimated, were absolutely destroyed by World War II. So we just have to keep that in mind. The numbers of people, the infrastructure, the material destruction, the human destruction, those were the two countries that suffered the most in World War II. So the United States emerges from World War II as the world's single superpower. And we see this very quickly by the rise of U.S. interventionism around the planet. That is, U.S. troops, U.S. bases are everywhere. The Soviet Union and China do have foreign policies, but they're very reluctant to get involved anywhere beyond their immediate borders. It's the United States that's everywhere. At the same time, though, the Soviet Union makes a strategic decision to support the revolutionary process in Cuba. There are no Soviet troops in Cuba. The Cuban Revolution is fought by Cubans. There are no Russians there advising them. It's a completely nationalist Cuban revolution. However, once they're in power, the USSR does make the strategic decision to support them. Now, Cuba, the Cuban Revolution, the July 26th movement coming into power, is looking around for allies, as every anti-colonial movement is. They look to the United States to support their struggles against colonialism, their struggles for self-determination. The United States refuses to support any anti-colonial struggles, whether in Cuba, whether in Vietnam. It's intent on maintaining a world order in which it keeps the control. So once the United States makes the decision that it is going to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, that's when Cuba turns to the Soviet Union. And for strategic reasons, the USSR decides to support Cuba. Now, this draws Cuba into a series of economic decisions, especially in the late 60s and early 70s, that make it extremely dependent on the USSR. But the United States was a major actor in this. That is, if the United States had followed a different path after 1959, had decided to allow Cuban independence, had decided to maintain cordial relations with the revolutionary government in Cuba, Cuba's relationship with the USSR could have happened, developed very differently. But the second part of what you said is also completely true. That is, by being forced into this economic dependence on the Soviet Union, Cuba was left extremely vulnerable with the collapse of the Soviet bloc in 1989-1991, right. And the floor fell out from under Cuba's economy, and it fell into deep economic crisis in the early 1990s, which it's still trying to recover from, and still in the context of U.S. economic hostility, despite the restoration of diplomatic relations at the end of 2014.
So I'm curious a couple of things here. That in all of the times you've been to Cuba, you've been there numerous times, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm.
And the times I've been back and forth, I never had the chance to sit down or meet with Fidel, which is I've always felt terrible about. But anyway, that's reality. So, have you met him?
No, I have not had the opportunity to meet him.
And B, as we think about this younger generation, people in their 20s and 30s and younger who, for whom this word, the name Fidel Castro means something very different than it does for people of our generation, mm-hmm. People in their 50s, 60s and 70s. So how would you begin the remembrance of Fidel for the younger generation? What as a teacher, as a thinker, as an activist, what would you say that Fidel, what would you leave them with when it comes to Fidel Castro?
Well, are you talking about young people in Cuba or young people in the United States?
Here, in the United States.
Okay. So, well, yeah, I'm a history professor.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's absolutely essential that young people know this history. And, you know, I was just in Oakland for Thanksgiving, and I went to the Oakland Museum, Oakland, California, where there's an exhibit on the history of the Black Panthers.
Oh, right,
And it was absolutely packed, and it was so inspiring, and I feel like this is a history that, wow, I wish I could take all of my students to that exhibit, to sort of bring them into the sort of heady revolutionary sentiment of the time, the feeling that, and I mean, one of the things that I find the most frustrating as a teacher is how disenchanted with politics, and I don't just mean the electoral system, but with political activism in general, so many young people are this sort of sense that, well, it's not going to make any difference. It doesn't really affect me. There's nothing we can do about it anyway. The system's just too strong. To be brought back into this moment where so many people around the world felt like, no, we actually can change the world. And I think that's something really, really important for the generations that are coming of age now to be made aware of.
And finally, I'm curious where you think, with the death of Fidel Castro and, of course, the election now of Donald Trump, as President of the United States, every time I say it, I shudder a little bit. But I say, that when you with the juxtaposition of these two events,
mm-hmm.
what do you think? What are your thoughts about the future of Cuba? What it might have meant, might the opening of Cuba, as we call it, quote unquote, the opening of Cuba, might have meant something very different under Obama than Trump. Though many of the same forces would have gone in and wanted to retake Cuba. Which, and one of the things I learned from my last visit to Cuba, which was no different than any other visit I made there, was that the people themselves, what they were worried about was losing all the gains they made,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
whether it's free housing or medical care or their education system,
uh-huh.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, what does this portend? Do you think his death and the incoming Trump?
Well, I think it's a lot easier to make predictions about what Fidel's death portends than it is to make predictions about what Donald Trump's presidency portends.
Right.
I mean, you know, Fidel Castro did step down from power a decade ago. There has been an orderly transition in Cuba, and Cuba has changed a lot since 1989. Every time I go to Cuba, which I started doing in 1994, I see a lot of changes. But surely if I had been traveling there before 1994, I would have seen changes also. That is, Cuba has never been static. Cuba was very different in 1965 from 1975, very different in 1975 from 1985, and different in 1985 from 95, et cetera. So I don't believe that Fidel Castro's death is going to bring dramatic changes of any sort to the political and economic system of Cuba. I think Cuba's political and economic system has been in a process of evolution ever since 1959, and that will continue. However, so I have to say I was surprised by President Obama's announcement in December of 2014 about the reestablishment of relations with Cuba. I did not foresee that coming. But I think with the election of Donald Trump, you know, he's made a lot of promises in a lot of different areas, and he's not going to fulfill all of those promises. So he has expressed that he opposes the opening to Cuba, but is that going to be an area in which he chooses to take action early in his presidency or ever in his presidency? Or is it going to be one of the many things he said that he's not going to take action on, or he's going to take opposite action on? So, you know, I think we can say that from an ideological position, he's appealing to the far right by saying we don't want to have relations with Cuba. As a businessman, he wants to have relations with Cuba. Who is the constituency who he's appealing to? You know, for his populist, you know, build a wall, bring back American jobs constituency, I don't think they care about relations with Cuba, so I don't think it's something he would pursue for that reason. The business community in general wants better relations with Cuba, wants to be able to invest in Cuba. So, you know, I almost feel like Trump's policy toward Cuba could go in almost any direction, and I don't know which one it'll take.
Well, we shall see, and I look forward to having many more conversations with you about that, but also about what happens to our immigration policy in America in this new incoming administration. You'll have a great deal to say about that, I know. Dr. Aviva Chomsky, of course, the last time we spoke, we talked about her book, The Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal, and where this, I'm curious where this may take us. And Dr. Aviva Chomsky, excuse me, I have a cold today. I apologize for my little stumbles. Dr. Aviva Chomsky, thank you so much for being with us today. I deeply appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.